We stayed in touch over the years, speaking on the phone now and then. 7 years after our first talk, Oprah called again. "I am restructuring my show this fall," she said. "Will you help me get some clarity?" I felt a growing excitement. "I could retire and count the shoes in my closet," she continued, "but I want to give something to the world. I want to create television that helps people change their lives." Suddenly, I was electrified. Her words thrilled me. "I am creating a short segment called Remembering the Spirit at the end of each show. What do you think?" I thought it was a good idea. When we hung up, I started writing my thoughts. I sent them to Oprah, and a few weeks later a producer called. "May we send a crew to your house next week?" he asked. "We are taping Remembering the Spirit segments. Yesterday we taped a scholar feeding his chickens. The day before, we taped a woman meditating." I called Oprah to decline. "A video of me walking on a mountain will not inspire anyone," I told her. "No," she shouted. "Talk about the seat of the soul. That's what you talk about. Talk about the things in your book." I felt the electricity again. "I'll do it," I exclaimed. I expected a film crew to come the next week, but another call came instead. "Will you fly to Chicago tomorrow," asked the producer, "and tape an interview with Oprah the next day?" This time I felt very differently than I had during my first conversation with Oprah. This time, her invitation felt exactly right. I didn't feel frightened. I didn't feel overwhelmed. I felt like a surfer feels when a perfect wave comes. All I needed to do was to stand up on my board. I knew the ride would be wonderful. Linda felt the same way, and we flew to Chicago to meet Oprah. It was fun. Oprah became part of our family immediately. She thought I might look like a mountain man and have a big stomach and a gray beard. "He looks normal," she exclaimed. "I can put him on television." We prayed together that our show would be the most empowering we could make it. Then we sat down in front of cameras to talk. Oprah had planned to tape another show after our interview, but it was canceled. We talked for 2.5 hours. When we were done, she said excitedly, "I can make several Remembering the Spirit segments from this." Then she thought of something else. "I'll make a Christmas special from this interview and give it to my viewers as a holiday gift." She did. It aired Christmas Eve afternoon. Our time together was that easy. I had met a new friend. We had talked about things that I love the most. We decided to do it again, and Linda and I went home. The results were as spectacular as they were easy. Oprah made 8 Remembering the Spirit segments from our interview. The Seat of the Soul appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. By the time the Christmas special aired, it was already number 1. Cooperation feels like that. It is as easy as play. It isn't just working together on a common goal, like making money, electing a president, or raising a family. That is the joint pursuit of external power. When people do that, their goal is the most important thing to them. When they reach it, they find other goals in common, or they go different ways. From the point of view of your soul, cooperation is play. People cooperate because they want to be together, not because they share goals. People come first, and goals come second. People who want to be together always think of things to do together, just as children always think of games to play. Who do you want to play with? Sharing. I went to high school in a small town in Kansas. The best thing about it for me was my debate coach, Dan. Dan also taught English and occasionally drama. I was glad that he wasn't my English teacher, because his English was horrible. I cringed every time he said things like, "He don't," but after a while, I didn't care how Dan spoke. Knowing him changed my life, and I still love him. Our tiny school competed in debate against huge schools in Kansas City and medium-sized schools around the state. We usually won the state championship and everything else. The walls of our classroom were covered with shelves full of trophies. So were the walls of the hall outside, down to the next classroom. We traveled in a military surplus van, which had been painted blue. We called it the Blue Bomb, and made bets about where it would break down next. I was too young to know how uncomfortable the Blue Bomb was. But years later, I realized that Dan was not. He drove us everywhere, to tournament after tournament, weekend after weekend. I looked forward to debate class. We met at Dan's house in the evenings to practice in the basement. His daughters grew up sharing their house with debaters. I am not the only one whose life was changed by Dan. I soaked up his warmth, humor, and optimism, and so did everyone else. He was the teacher, and we were the students. But there was a bond between us that felt like friendship to me. I believe now that it was. He took the time from his evenings and weekends, from his family, and from his love of golf to be with us. He gave freely of himself, and without really knowing much about debate, we won tournament after tournament, like the classes before us and the classes after. When I applied to Harvard, Dan wrote a long, passionate letter of recommendation for me. Someone must have spell-checked his English. I believe his letter was why I was accepted. Dan passed on long ago. I am now older than he was when he drove me to tournaments, but he is still a part of me. That is because Dan knew how to share. Sharing doesn't mean simply letting a friend drive your car, lending some money, or even helping a neighbor in need. It means giving something of yourself that is important. After running for a year, Linda realized that she wanted to run a marathon. She and her running partner, Terry, decided to train together and run one together in the fall. They intensified their schedule, running 6 miles a day every day and 10 miles once a week. As the day of the marathon approached, they were both healthy and ready. The race started well and went that way until mile 20, when Terry's leg began to hurt. His pace dropped off, and then he slowed to a walk. As he did, Linda slowed also, and at last began to walk with him. "Go on," he told her. "I'm not going to finish." "Well, why don't you go just a little farther?" she suggested. He did, but a little while later, he said the same thing. "Go on. I'm not going to make it." "Let's go just a little farther," she suggested again. And again, he did. They both finished the race that way, walking, with Terry going just a little farther, time after time. "Didn't you want to finish the race running?" I asked her later. "Of course I did," she said, "but I knew how Terry would feel if he didn't finish." That is sharing. When you give something as important as that, you also receive a gift. Once I was invited to a Lomi Lomi class. Lomi Lomi is an ancient Hawaiian form of bodywork and lifestyle. One of the students there was wearing a beautiful carved hook around his neck. It was more than jewelry. It was powerful and graceful. I felt soothed and calmed when I looked at it. When the class was over, he came toward me. A painful expression crossed his face, and then he took the hook from his neck and put it around mine. "This is for you," he said, towering above me. "In Hawaii, we use hooks like these to catch what we need." I was thrilled. I decided to use my hook to catch patience and wisdom. I wore it every day. I put it on in the morning and slept with it by my bed. Several years later, a group of us were standing on Mount Shasta, a holy mountain in California. We prayed in a circle and gave thanks for the retreat we had just given together. One of us, Benjamin, offered to sing a song that he heard in a dream. As he knelt on the earth, preparing to sing, something surprising happened to me. I wanted to give Benjamin my hook. I remembered the painful expression on the face of the young Hawaiian who gave the hook to me. Just as he had done, I took the hook from my neck. Then I put it around Benjamin's. Giving Benjamin my hook showed me how much I had changed. Before, I could not have given away something so precious to me. Now I couldn't not give it to Benjamin. The gift that I received was seeing how much I had changed, what a considerate person I had become. Even if Benjamin hadn't liked my hook, even if he had thrown it away, the gift that I got from giving it would be mine forever. When I saw Benjamin next, years later, he was still wearing his hook. It means a lot to him. That is why I suspect that, sooner or later, he will give it away. If you give only what is easy to give, you can't grow. That is like giving away tomatoes when your garden is full of tomatoes. Sharing things that are important is like giving away tomatoes when you only have a few left, and you love tomatoes. You have to care about people to do that. This is the kind of sharing your soul wants to do. Reverence for Life. The car in front of me was still at the stop sign. His left turn signal was still blinking. One car after another passed through the intersection, with lots of room between each of them. What is he waiting for? I asked myself impatiently. At last the car moved. I followed it through the intersection, and a moment later found myself behind it again. The driver was not in a hurry. There were no cars in front of him, but he was going very slowly. I was late for my appointment. He must be senile, I fumed. The road widened, and I passed as soon as I could. When I did, I looked over to see the driver. It was Herb, my friend. I was delighted to see him. A moment earlier, I was furious with him. I waved, and he waved back. Everything had changed because I saw something that I hadn't seen before. The driver was my friend. Reverence is like that. It is seeing something that you haven't seen before. You recognize friends wherever you look. The lean man closed the door to his old truck. It was stacked high with firewood for me. Slowly, he walked toward me and put out his hand. "Good day," he said. "Your firewood will cost more this year." I didn't expect that news. I didn't like it either. But there was nothing I could do. Winter was coming, and I had waited too long to buy my wood. "Stack it there," I told him, pointing to the empty woodshed. "My nephew will do that," he said, nodding to the boy in his truck. "I'll be back with the rest." I felt angry. The boy began to stack the wood. I noticed how carefully he placed each piece. "Do you like working for your uncle?" I asked, making some conversation while I watched him work. "Yes," he said, without stopping. "Why?" I asked. "This will pay for my school clothes," he said, pointing to the unstacked pile of wood he had thrown from the truck. Then he smiled directly at me. "We don't have any money." I melted. Suddenly, I liked being with him, and I liked his uncle, too. I wasn't angry anymore. I was glad to buy the boys' clothes for school. It seemed to me that we had a perfect arrangement. I get firewood, and they get school clothes. I saw something that I hadn't seen. Before, I saw people selling wood. Afterward, I saw an uncle and his nephew working to buy school clothes. Reverence is like this, too. It is seeing beneath the surface. Before I recognized Herb, I saw only a slow driver. Afterward, I still saw a slow driver, but I also saw my friend. Before I talked with the boy, I saw only a woodcutter and his nephew. Afterward, I saw a woodcutter and his nephew, but I also saw two friends. Your soul always sees friends. That is because it sees beneath the surface. When you see a friend wearing a beautiful dress, do you think she is beautiful because of her dress? When you see her in a dress that you don't like, isn't she still your beautiful friend? When you see with reverence, you see everyone as a beautiful friend, even if he's driving slowly, like Herb, or doing something you might not expect, such as raising the price of your firewood. When you see with reverence, you see holiness in everything. Holiness is like the friend inside of the dress. You see the dress, and you see your friend, too. Your friend is the important thing, not her dress. Holiness is like the ocean. What you see with your five senses is like the waves in the ocean. There are so many that you can never see them all. Some are large and some are small. All of them have a different shape and a different way of moving. All of them change in their own way and disappear into the ocean in their own way. Each one is unique. Reverence is loving the ocean. Authentic power. A friend of mine, a physicist, called one day to say, "There is a meeting this Friday at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. It's about quantum physics. Want to come?" I went out of curiosity. I didn't expect to understand what I heard, but I did. It was the most profound discussion I could imagine, about questions such as, "Does consciousness create reality?" I left the meeting very excited, though I couldn't explain what was exciting me. My friends knew that I was excited and that it had to do with quantum physics. That was all I knew, too. I went to the next meeting and the next. Then I started going every week. I asked questions. I also started reading about quantum physics. Little by little, I began to understand it, and the more I understood, the more excited I became. I decided to write a book. I wanted to leave a gift for people who would become interested in quantum physics in the future. I asked the physicist at the meeting to help me, and they agreed. My journey had begun. I had never written a book before or studied science. That didn't matter to me. I looked forward to reading about physics and writing about physics. I looked forward to talking about physics and thinking about physics. I thought of questions and tried to answer them. I had found the most engaging activity of my life. It was also the most fulfilling. When I wrote, I forgot about paying the rent, although I didn't know where I would get the money. I forgot to be angry, which I usually was. I also forgot to be resentful and jealous. Can you imagine the most beautiful island in the world? At every opportunity, you row to the island. At last your friends tell you, "Don't work so hard. You don't need to row every day to that island. It will still be there tomorrow." That is what my friends told me. But the island was my book, and I never wanted to leave it. This was my first experience of authentic power. Authentic power feels good. It is doing what you are supposed to be doing. It is fulfilling. Your life is filled with meaning and purpose. You have no doubts. You have no fears. You are happy to be alive. You have a reason to be alive. Everything you do is joyful. Everything is exciting. You look forward to each day and each night. You are not worried about doing something wrong, making a mistake, or failing. You do not compare yourself with others. You do not compare what you do with what others do. You can experience authentic power caring for a child or cooking a meal. You can experience it building a house or, like me, writing a book. It doesn't come from what you are doing. It comes from how you are doing it. You can experience authentic power at work, at school, or anywhere else. Authentic power is different from external power. External power is the ability to manipulate and control. External power feels different from authentic power. It is trying to impress people, do the right thing, or succeed. It is trying to be better, smarter, stronger, or more beautiful. The governor of Kyoto arrived at the monastery.
"I give this card to the abbot," he told the monk at the gate. "I have an appointment with him at 3 o'clock."
When the abbot read the card, he said, "I don't know this man. Send him away." The monk returned the card to the governor. The governor looked at it and then crossed out the words, "Governor of Kyoto."
"I give this to the abbot," he said again.
"Show this man in," said the abbot. "I have an appointment with him at 3 o'clock." The governor thought that his title would impress the abbot, but the abbot was not impressed. Do you use titles to impress people, like beautiful, educated, strong, and wealthy? That is using external power. It is very different from authentic power. You forget to be frightened when you experience authentic power. You are always frightened when you use external power. External power comes and goes, like the value of your stock portfolio or the number of trees in your orchard. Pursuing it is a full-time job. It is hard to be more beautiful, wealthy, loving, intelligent, kind, or efficient than other people. Sooner or later, someone will be more beautiful, wealthy, loving, intelligent, kind, or efficient than you. Then they will have the external power. Creating authentic power is a full-time job too, but it doesn't depend on what happens outside of you. It depends on what happens inside. Creating authentic power. "There are many types of bread," Tony said with a flourish of his index finger, giving it a little spin and pointing it upward. "Today we will learn how to bake the most basic kind, but, of course, bake it to perfection." He stood behind his counter in the studio. Cameras moved in and out to catch his every motion and smile. "There is only one way to bake bread," he continued with a grin. "First, you must want to do it. Second, you must have flour, water, yeast, and salt." So began another of Tony's delightful cooking courses. Across the city, novice and expert cooks alike took notes or stood in their own kitchens, following Tony step by step. "First, mix the yeast, flour, and water like this," he demonstrated, roughly measuring each ingredient and stirring it in with a wooden spoon. "Then put the dough on a countertop, like this, and begin sprinkling in more flour. Knead the dough as you do, using your hands and arms as well as your fingers, like this." His body rocked rhythmically back and forth as he lovingly kneaded the lump of dough, which was growing softer and more malleable. "Don't forget to add a little salt and maybe a little sugar," he continued. "So much of baking is personal taste. Experiment. Let yourself be guided. It's your bread you're baking." Creating authentic power is like baking bread. First, you have to want to do it. Then you need to follow the recipe. If you do these things, you'll have lots of opportunities to experiment and be guided by your inner promptings. As with bread, it's your own loaf that you're baking. Unlike bread, no one else can bake it for you. The recipe for authentic power is as simple as the recipe for bread: harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life. Those are the ingredients. How you put them together depends on you, but without all of them, authentic power is not possible any more than bread is possible without the ingredients that are required to make it. This is how to do it. First, clear the countertop of everything but what you will need to bake authentic power. That means put every intention aside for the moment except the intentions to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life in your own life. Second, keep doing it. Soon you will start to create some harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life. The bread is baking. Eventually, you will create these things moment by moment, choice by choice. That is authentic power. Experiences of fulfillment, meaning, and awareness can be created. This is big news. It is not necessary to be filled with anger, jealousy, sorrow, and fear. All it takes is the desire to create authentic power and the will to do it. The desire to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life, and the will to create them when you are angry, jealous, sad, and frightened. Understanding how to create authentic power is easy compared to actually doing it, but the same is true about anything that develops you. Baseball is easy to understand. Becoming a good player is more difficult. First, you have to get into good condition, and you have to stay that way. Then you have to learn skills, such as pitching, catching, and batting. Then you need to practice, practice, and practice. This requires other people. You need a team to play on, and other teams for your team to play. Anyone can understand baseball in an afternoon, but no one can become a good player overnight. Everyone needs time to learn, practice, apply, and then learn, practice, and apply again. This takes time and intention. It takes focus and determination. So does creating authentic power. Knowing how is easy. Just set the intentions to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life no matter what, and keep them. The rest is learning what these things mean, how to do them, and practice. That takes time. You also need other people to practice with. In this case, you don't have to recruit them. They are always there. They are the ones you get angry at, jealous of, sad about, or frightened of. To improve your ball game, you have to become aware of yourself. For example, you need to become conscious of how your body moves when you swing the bat. Great batters know exactly what they are doing as they do it. They don't close their eyes and swing. They are conscious of every muscle. Are you aware of your intentions? When you are angry, what are your intentions? When you are jealous, what are your intentions? Trying to change your intentions when you don't know what they are is like trying to go to New York when you don't know where you're starting from. Going to New York from San Francisco is one thing. Getting there from Paris is another. When you are aware of all of your intentions, you are like a great batter who is conscious of every muscle as he moves his body toward the ball. He can change what needs to be changed. He knows how to get where he wants to go because he knows exactly where he is. When you choose your intentions according to what you want to create, that is responsible choice. When you intend to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life, your intentions and the intentions of your soul are the same. When that happens, you become authentically powerful. Creating authentic power is a process. Each time you choose harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life, you challenge parts of yourself that want other things. They are the parts of you that are angry, sad, jealous, and frightened. The more you challenge them, the less power they have over you, and the more power you have over them. Eventually, their power over you disappears. That is how authentic power is created, intention by intention, choice by choice. You cannot wish it, pray it, or meditate it into being any more than you can wish, pray, or meditate yourself into being a great baseball player. If you want to bake bread, you have to know how to do it. If you want to create authentic power, you have to know how to do that, too. Then you have to do it. Thank you. Forgiveness.
Kill him, said the brother. His face was set like stone. Kill him, said the mother through her tears. Kill him, said the sister, her voice quivering.
Around the council fire, each member of the family spoke. In the balance lay the life of the young man sitting restlessly outside. Murder is a terrible thing. Murder of a friend is more terrible yet. Yet there he sat, the blood of his friend still on his hands, awaiting his fate.
Let us think this through, spoke the grandfather softly. Sorrow deepened the lines on his wrinkled face. Generation spoke through him. Will killing him return our boy to us?
No.
No.
No. The word moved slowly around the tortured circle, sometimes whispered, sometimes murmured, sometimes spoken spitefully.
Will killing him help feed our people? Asked the old man, his eyes steady.
Again, no. Then, no. Then, no. Moved around the circle.
My brother speaks the truth, said the great uncle. All faces turned toward him. A tear ran slowly down his cheek.
Let us look at this matter carefully.
They did look at it carefully. They deliberated through the night. Then they called the young man to his fate.
See that teepee? They said, pointing to the teepee of the young man he had killed.
He nodded.
It's yours now.
See those horses? They said, pointing to the dead man's horses.
He nodded again.
They are yours now.
You are now our son. You will take the place of the one you have killed.
He looked slowly to the faces surrounding him. His new life had begun, and so had theirs.
Brown Bear looked across the table at me.
That happened in the late 1800s, he said. They could have killed him. Tribal law gave them the right.
I sat amazed as Brown Bear's words sank into me. Could the family of a murdered boy adopt the murderer as their son?
The young man became a devoted son, Brown Bear continued. By the time he died, he was known in all the tribes as the model of a loving son.
This is forgiveness.
Authentically empowered people forgive naturally. They forgive because they do not want to carry the burden of not forgiving like heavy suitcases through a crowded airport. The family of the murdered boy could have killed his killer. Instead, they took him as their son. That changed their lives and his. They did not know how their decision would affect the young man, but they felt the effects of it on themselves. They did not have to hate him. They did not have to live with his death in their hearts, as well as the death of their son.
Have you ever thought that someone treated you badly, and then thought about it again and again? How did that make you feel? Were you angry, or sad, or frightened?
That is what they gave up. Until you can forgive, you cannot use all of your creativity. Part of you is thinking about what you have not forgiven. Do you want to live your life that way? Is it worth it? Is anything worth that?
Forgiveness and harmony go together. When you forgive someone, nothing stands between you and that person. Even if the person you forgive does not like you, you have laid your suitcases down. You travel lightly. When you are harmonious, you are playful. You delight in people. Not forgiving stops this. Forgiving opens the door to it.
Harmony does not only mean harmony with other people. Are you in harmony with yourself? Do parts of yourself frighten you or make you angry? Can you forgive those parts? Are you afraid of dropping the ball, losing the deal, or failing the test? Imagine that each time you get angry at yourself, you put a brick into a backpack that you are wearing. Can you enjoy yourself while you are wearing a backpack full of bricks? Are you in harmony with the universe? Do you think it has wronged you? How happy can you be while you are holding a grudge against the universe? This is the real issue. What you feel about the universe shows what you feel about yourself. Are you afraid of your anger? You will also be afraid of an angry universe. The universe isn't angry, but you will be afraid that it is. Hating yourself and hating the universe are the same thing. Loving yourself and loving the universe are the same thing. Not forgiving the universe is a heavy burden to carry. Why not lighten your load? In fact, why not get rid of it? If forgiving the universe seems more than you can do, start by forgiving another person. Put down one suitcase at a time. That is how you create harmony. It is also how you forgive. Humbleness. She put the violin under her chin. One by one, she looked at each of the other musicians. Then, with a nod of her head that was almost invisible, the music began. Soft sounds from a guitar blended with the rich tones of a tenor sax. A drummer caressed cymbals with a steel brush. Through it all floated the thin, lilting melody of her violin. Together they moved through a realm so sweet and sometimes so frantic that it seemed to me they were all watching the same conductor. If so, no one else saw him. The four musicians stood alone on the stage, each adding what only he or she could to a creation that could not have happened without all of them. A melody emerged, but no one person played it. They were each playing different melodies, but together they played a melody that was different still. The music became fuller and louder, richer and more complicated. Then the guitar, the drums, and the saxophone began to play more softly. Moments later, an amazing sound came from my friend's violin. Soaring and dancing, tumbling and flowing, up and down and up again, it filled the room. Sweetly, then harshly, then softly again, a new melody snaked its way from the old, returned to it, and left it again. The guitar, saxophone, and drums played with it at every turn of its journey, sometimes supporting, sometimes challenging, and sometimes moving with it. I had never heard jazz like this before. My friend finished her astounding performance with a flourish. I could not keep myself from clapping. Even before the applause faded, the guitarist began to rock gently on his stool, as if he were praying. Sweet notes slowly appeared as if from nowhere. The contrast of the guitar with the violin was gentle, yet stirring. In his own way, in his own time, he captivated us, excited us, delighted us, and soothed us. Beside his sounds, beneath his sounds, and through his sounds, the sax, drums, and violin filled in all that was missing and made space for all that he gave. Again, the room burst into applause. In turn, the saxophone player and the drummer stepped to the center of the musical circle. Each gave completely, led, yet also joined, glowing in the musical light that the others shone on him and her. Applause exploded again and again as the music grew deeper and fuller. Then, slowly, they began to roll away the layers of complexity that each had contributed. Their sounds became softer, simpler, and sweeter, until, at last, in one lovely blending of notes and a drum roll, they ended together. The applause continued for a long time. The musicians nodded their acceptance to the audience and, I noticed, to one another. It seemed to me they had completed a remarkable journey, and the shared experience of it created a new and deeper bond between them, even though they played together often. Could it be that each journey they took together, each concert, was different? Did each performance take them to unexplored depths and bond them anew? I asked my friend, and she said, yes. Sometimes we experiment with themes that we have discovered, and sometimes we create something new. No concert is like another, and some of them are very different. How do you do that? I asked. She thought a moment, and then said, "I listen very hard, so that what I play will be right. Not right in the sense of right or wrong, but right in the sense of what is needed. Together we find, or maybe we discover, or maybe we create, the groove. I can't tell you what it is, but I know when I'm in it. We all do." I listened quietly. "Finding the groove requires two things from me," she added, as if thinking this through for the first time. "What are they?" I asked. "Complete self-responsibility and complete surrender," she answered simply, nodding her head in approval of her clarity. That is cooperation. It is also humbleness. Cooperation and humbleness always go together. Humbleness is seeing that everyone's path through the Earth School is as difficult as yours, and as important. It is not pretending that you are meek or inferior. It is making the music together that cannot be made alone, and that cannot be made without the music that only you, alone, can make. You can be humble only with friends. If you feel that you are less than another person, you will be intimidated and frightened of making mistakes. If you feel that you are more important, you will not share everything that you can because you will not respect the person you are with. Can you give your best to someone you don't think can appreciate it? When you are friends, giving and receiving is the groove. Everyone offers what he or she has. Everyone supports everyone else. Each steps to the microphone when it is his or her time, and each plays in the background when it's someone else's time. The music that you make together is special, and everyone knows it. You love to play it and to hear it. Humble people feel that way all the time. They look at themselves as friends, and they look at others as friends. They cooperate naturally. If you do not cooperate naturally, set the intention to cooperate. Then set it again and again. Eventually, you will become humble without noticing it. Clarity. I had never been to the summit in weather like this. The sky was flawless, the air was warm, and a soft breeze caressed us. 2 miles below, cars crawled along a freeway like ants. A frozen lake in the crater of an adjoining mountain melted slowly into turquoise blue. Everywhere I looked, unspoiled snow, glaciers, rock warming in the sun, or blue to the horizon met my eyes. Talbot looked at me and smiled. This was our third trip together. He had never seen conditions like these on the summit either. "It's good to be here with you," he said. "It's good to be here, my friend," I replied with gratitude. We had been climbing 9 hours. There was no place left to climb. We had reached the top, where Earth touches air for the last time. Not only were we on the summit, we were there with time to relax before starting down. I sat on the highest outcropping of this magnificent mountain. The sun warmed me, and my eyelids became heavy. I let them fall until I was in darkness. The joy of being at the summit on this beautiful day washed over me. I gave thanks for my healthy body. I thought of the many people who would never see this special place. I felt blessed. Slowly, my arms floated upward until they were above my head, fingers reaching toward the sky. It didn't take any effort to keep them there. That's when it happened. I suddenly saw myself, the summit, and everything else differently. Before, I considered the summit to be a special place. It still was. But what I saw with my eyes closed was this. Every place is the summit. The grocery store is the summit. My home is the summit. School is the summit. There is no place that is not the summit. This is clarity. "Give me the best flower that you have," said a man to the florist. "Every flower here is the best," replied the florist. At these words, the man became enlightened. This man had the same kind of experience that I had. It can happen to anyone. It can happen quickly or slowly. It can happen when you are young or when you are old. When you see, even for a moment, that what you thought was special is not more special than anything else, that is clarity. Clarity is seeing that everything and every person is special, no matter who or what it is. A Navajo prayer says, "Beauty above me, beauty below me, beauty in front of me, beauty behind me, all around me, beauty." This is very different from the way that most people see. Most people think that some of their experiences are more beautiful than others, and that some people are more special than others. Which way is real? Imagine walking along a beach on a foggy day. You cannot see very far. You hear waves crashing on rocks, seagulls crying, and the wind blowing. Cold penetrates your clothes, and you shiver. Everywhere it is wet and gray. Sounds come from places you cannot see. You are frightened. Now imagine that you are walking on the same beach, and the sun is shining. Sunlight sparkles on the water. Gulls fly through a cloudless sky. Cliffs with wildflowers tower above. Your feet sink into warm and welcome sand. Which way of seeing is real? Clarity is seeing without the fog. It is getting your bearings in a well-lighted landscape. It is seeing without restrictions. At one time or another, almost all of us have wakened in the night, frightened or crying. "Thank goodness," we say when we realize where we are. Clarity is realizing where you are. It is exchanging a frightening experience of the dark for a wholesome experience of the light. Clarity and sharing are twins. Where one goes, the other goes. When you share, you give something special to a special person. When you see clearly, everyone and everything is special. So each time you share, you learn to see clearly. The more you do it, the better at it you become. When you take the time to be with someone, that is a gift. When you share what you are feeling, even when you are afraid, that is a gift too. Caring for someone is always a gift. It is the best gift that you can give. When you give gifts like these, you start to receive them. After a while, everything that you give and receive is a gift. The trees and the mountains are also gifts. Who gave them? Who gave the animals, the birds, and your life? They are gifts from the universe. Another gift that you get from the universe is an experience that is perfect for you. This gift comes each moment from the time that you were born until the time you die. You and the universe create this gift together. You decide what it will be, and the universe gives it to you. That is the golden rule. What you do to people, people do to you. It is also called karma. If you don't like what people do to you, you can change that by doing different things to them. That is how you and the universe work together. Each moment you choose a new gift, and when the time is right, the universe gives it to you. Each day brings gifts that you have ordered, and each day you place more orders. You do this by setting your intentions and then acting on them. The universe takes your orders and delivers them. Everyone gets what she or he ordered. If you order fear, you get it. If you order love, you get it. When you order, you share with the universe. When your order is filled, the universe shares with you. Complaining about your gifts is walking in the fog. Recognizing your gifts and who ordered them is walking in the sunshine. Walking in the sunshine is clarity. Love. The enormous redwood tree, ancient and failing, trembled. With a cracking, tearing sound, the unimaginable began to happen. Near the base, one side of the giant trunk began to crumple, like the first three floors of a collapsing building. On the opposite side, more than 20 feet away, a split suddenly appeared in the massive bark. The split grew vertically, slowly for a moment, then more rapidly as it widened. Ever so slowly, the mountain of wood, thousands of years old, began to move. In a canopy, hundreds of feet above the forest floor, the top swayed in the wind. But this time, when it reached the end of its sway, it continued downward. The ripping, tearing sound grew until it was louder than the roar of a freight train. Tons of fiber, centuries in the making, started their last journey. As the giant fell, it sheared huge branches, larger than oak trees from neighboring redwoods. Down and down it fell with awesome force. Nothing could stop it now, and nothing did. It hit the forest floor, bounced once, and came to a final rest. The thunder fell silent. In a few minutes, thousands of years of reaching toward the sun ended in one final embrace of the earth. Slowly, the sounds of the forest returned. Insects buzzed, and leaves rustled in the breeze. Small animals reappeared cautiously, and larger animals began to move again. This is part of a love story. The leaves, the trunk, the branches, and the roots were in love with each other. Their love was continual. New leaves gently replaced those that turned brown. The redwood remained green for centuries, but none of the leaves on it were centuries old. The bark loved the roots, and the roots loved the branches. The trunk held them together, and the leaves nourished them all. The love story of the redwood tree had other characters in it, too. It loved the earth and the sky. It reached for them both from the moment it sprouted to the moment of its dramatic fall. It loved the birds that nested in its branches, the animals that sheltered beneath it, and the insects that fed from its bark. They were one family, full and complete. Does this story sound familiar? It should. You see it everywhere you look, inside and out. The cells in your body love each other. Your blood loves your heart and your lungs. Your spine loves your brain. Your body is a love story that continues day after day. Every part of your body gives what other parts need and receives from them what it needs. You are a walking, talking story of love. Every love story is part of a larger love story. And every love story, no matter how large or small, has endless stories of love within it. The universe has countless galaxies. Each galaxy has countless stars. Each star has countless atoms, molecules, and subatomic particles dancing within it, becoming one another, splitting apart in different ways, and coming together again. The biggest love story has no beginning, like we do, and like redwood trees do. It doesn't have an end, either. We are parts of that story. Sometimes when we glimpse it, we are awed and delighted. Scientists call this big love story interconnectivity. Nothing exists without everything else. When we think that anything can exist without us, it is because we are only seeing a small part of a few love stories. Sometimes we don't even see our own. The love stories happen whether we see them or not. The love story of the tree does not end when the tree falls. A new chapter begins. The tree decays and gives all of itself back to the earth. Insects devour it, and birds eat the insects. Bees make hives in it, and bears eat honey from the hives. Even when the tree disappears, the story is not over. More trees appear, and more insects, birds, and animals too. The story never ends. When the forest disappears, the story does not end. Even when the earth ends, which it will do someday, the story does not end. It has no ending. Love and reverence go together. When you see the big love story, you realize that you are in everyone's story, and everyone and everything is in yours. Even people you haven't met yet are part of your story, and you are part of theirs. Their suffering is part of your story, and their happiness, too. Your suffering and happiness are part of theirs. The big love story includes everything. When your story becomes everyone's story, and everyone's story becomes yours, that is love. Trust. Ask the Creator for what you want, they told her, and the Creator will always answer you. They told her that since she was a baby. Now she was almost 7. I asked the Creator for something, she said one morning. What did you ask for, darling? For snow on my birthday, she said, giggling. Her parents looked at each other in alarm. The little girl's birthday was in July, and they lived in the desert. It is very hot in July in the desert. 2 weeks later, the little girl spoke again about her birthday. I want a party with all of my friends, she announced. Now they were very alarmed, but they arranged the party. Everyone came, had a wonderful time, and left. There was no snow, but the little girl didn't appear to be sad. Are you disappointed that the Creator didn't answer you? They asked her gently. He did answer me, she replied. He said, no. Some people call the Creator the universe. They think they know how the universe works, like the parents of the little girl. They are always disappointed and trying to understand why things happen. They are happy with some answers the universe gives them and unhappy with others. Why would the universe do this to me? They ask. This isn't fair, they say. The difference between these people and the little girl is trust. She is happy with any answer the universe gives. They aren't. They think they know how the universe should be. When it isn't that way, they get upset. Have you ever been so worried about something, like an exam, that you can't think about anything else? If your car won't start on exam day, you get frightened. If you leave your notes at home, you get angry. You want to pass your exam, but the universe wants you to do other things. Your exam is important, but learning about fear and anger is important too. That is more important to the universe.